Welcome back to the Vail News Podcast. Fred Dreyer coming to you from a sunny Monday here in Boulder, Colorado. Our series, Podcasting from Home, continues this week. So again, if you hear babies crying, dogs barking, birds chirping, loud music blaring, maybe some loud raffy children's music in the background, apologies. We are also adjusting to what it's like to work from home. This week, we're talking all about the Tour of Flanders. Had this been a normal year, this week would be the week before the Tour of Flanders. Tour of Flanders is my favorite bike race. If you ever get a chance to go check it out, I highly recommend it. Whenever friends or family would ask me about going and checking out the Tour de France, hey, what stages of the tour should we go watch? I would say, hey, skip the tour, go to Flanders, go check out, you know, Gent-Wevelgem, Tour of Flanders, Holy Week. It is. I can't begin to describe how much fun it is to be there for that race and how exciting it is to watch that race. So this week we're talking all about Flanders. We have gone back and watched three of our favorite recent editions of Tour of Flanders. That is editions held on the new course format. And we're going to break down these editions, talk about what we learned from rewatching them, insights we got into the race from going back and watching these YouTube clips, and just why these editions are so of interest to us. So Tour of Flanders centric episode of the Vail News Podcast. Hey, before we get started, I want to thank all of you who have been submitting emails to us after our episodes, especially after the Mid-South episode. I heard from a number of listeners who emailed us at webletters@vailnews.com about their perspective about the race, about the episode, about us being there. I appreciate you all reaching out. Our email address is always open. Definitely send us a note if you have some thoughts on your mind. Okay, let's get to it. My guests today are Andrew Hood and James Start, two men who have covered many editions of the Tour of Flanders. Before we get into it, guys, it's been a couple weeks since we caught up. What are conditions like in your respective homes, France and Spain? Hoodie, we'll start with you. What is daily life like in northern Spain right now?
Hi, Fred. Hi, everybody. Yeah, checking in here from northern Spain. Every night at 8 o'clock, everyone goes out on their patios and claps for about 5 minutes for all the first responders and healthcare workers and doctors inside all the hospitals, really working on the front lines during the coronavirus crisis. As probably most people are aware, you know, Spain's been hit pretty hard by this. You know, the death toll is pretty frightening when you look at some of the numbers. Over the weekend, I think more than 2,500 people died over a three-day span over this past weekend. Everyone's hoping that it's this top of this curve. Everyone's talking about day 17, I think, today of the lockdown. And man, it's getting stir crazy, you know. Luckily, knock wood, no one I know directly has been affected by this. Everyone being very respectful of the rules. And, you know, here in Spain, it's quite serious, both in terms of the level of how bad the virus really is kind of gone into the older parts of the community here. I mean, most of the the worst part of the death toll has been among the elderly. I think 80-85% of the death have been among people over 70. So, you know, everyone here in Spain is really trying to really follow the rule of the law. You know, here the lockdown is quite severe. We can't even go outside. I mean, the only time you can go outside is to go to the grocery store or go to the pharmacy or attend to some sort of emergency. So, I mean, I've been outside 3 days and 17 days, man. It's like going stir crazy, but it's pretty serious time. So these kind of chats obviously help. Just seeing your smiling face, Fred, you know, puts a smile on my face.
Puts a smile on my face, too. Readers or listeners should take note that Andy Hood has a very good quarantine beard going. It looks like one of those hockey rally beards from the playoffs. A little bit, you know, some gray in there, but Hoodie, you're doing your part. I'm liking the beard. How about you, James? You are in Paris, and France has its own set of rules and regulations. How would you describe what life is like for Parisians and life is like for you?
Well, hey, Fred. Hey, Andy. Hey, everybody. Just for note, I have way too much gray to even attempt a beard, so that's not going to happen. Shaving is sort of one way to sort of try to maintain some sort of semblance of normality, I guess, you know, a daily routine. So that's part of it. But really, on a more serious note, I would say very similar situation to Andy's. We're in lockdown. People are out on the balconies as well, or out on their windows at 8 o'clock for 60 seconds, not 5 minutes, every night, applauding the healthcare workers and all the first responders. But other than that, yeah, you're supposed to stay inside. I know people have been out once in 2 weeks. You can go out for groceries, pharmacy, up to about 20 minutes of exercise within a 1 kilometer radius of your home. And that's pretty much it. So that takes out cycling. I could go for a run, but I don't really like to do that. So I've been putting my bike on the fortunately, I have a balcony. I've been putting my bike on the balcony and doing the home trainer rides. I did, however, as a result of my journalist card, press card, and a letter from the editor, you, Fred, have the right to go to the Champs-Élysées yesterday, which is pretty fascinating. You know, I've so many times I go out to the Champs on Sunday and stroll down it because it's a wonderful place and a wonderful way to spend a Sunday. And it was a very special place yesterday. It was interesting being on the Champs-Élysées with nobody. I mean, just almost nobody. And it was sort of contrasting it to the many times when I've been there watching the Tour de France come in and went to some of the spots where I shoot the riders and stuff and shot a Champs-Élysées that was very, very, very empty, you know. In some ways it was kind of, you know, it was sort of attractive, but at the same time you can't share that with anybody because nobody else is allowed there, so that takes half the fun out of it. But it's, you know, it was a reminder of just how much the city is in lockdown, and we are very much, maybe not quite as much as Spain, but it's pretty close. I mean, I've gone out to get food and that's about it.
Yeah, and where I am here in Colorado, we are like a lot of states other than New York City and perhaps Seattle, in which, you know, it's all work from home orders. Our governor last week imposed a stay at home order so that, you know, everyone is, you know, public places are closed, restaurants are closed. People are encouraged to still go outside and get some exercise and go ride a bicycle, but the ski areas are closed. People are being discouraged from going backcountry skiing. You know, you can still get out and get some sunshine and some exercise, but very much being steered at home. And there's no bike racing going on, which, you know, I think we all understand why that is. And it is what it is. And we're living with it and dealing with it. But it is a small inconvenience that there's no Tour of Flanders this weekend. And that really bums me out because I love the Tour of Flanders. The Tour of Flanders, as I said, is my favorite race. There's the history, there's the course, there's the climbs. I love how tactical it is, and how, you know, year in, year out, you start to see the race won in different ways. And one thing I really love about Flanders, and I was thinking about in the lead up to this podcast, is that, you know, we're only 8 years now into the new Flanders course. That, of course, is the course that takes advantage of these climbs around Oudenaarde and has a circuit in which the riders go around and around and around before finishing in downtown Oudenaarde. You know, for 2012, they launched this new circuit. They went away from the old course, which we saw, you know, the Muur de Gerardsbergen and the Bosberg as the final two climbs, and into this new circuit. And so we're only 8 years in, and a lot of times teams, you know, they'll spend years sort of refining the tactics around a race and the, you know, how the terrain leads to the way a race is, how they approach a race. And I feel like since we're only 8 years in, the teams and the riders are still very much trying to figure out like what the best way is to win at Flanders. And so the three of us chose three different years to go back and rewatch. And what I like about it is all 3 years were won in different ways. So the years we're going to talk about this year, 2015, which is won by Alexander Kristoff, 2016, won by Peter Sagan, and 2019, won by Alberto Bettiol. Now, James, you chose 2015, the year that Alexander Kristoff won. What do you like about this edition? And, you know, going back and rewatching it, what are some of the things that stood out and the storylines around it?
Well, I just thought it was really a watershed year. It might not have been the most spectacular victory. You know, it wasn't like Sagan, you know, with the world championship stripes going off solo. That was really epic. It wasn't like Philippe Gilbert's amazing solo ride. But it was, I think, in so many ways, a watershed edition in ways like you referenced. We've been the world of cycling has been trying to figure out this new race course and what's the best way to race it. Even one team like Quickstep or De Koenig now has been winning it with different formats. And there's nothing set in stone yet. But what we saw with a year where Christoph won, attacking what, almost 30K out with Nicky Terpstra from Quickstep, was that riders could go from far out. And we've had several editions where, you know, up until that point, it was kind of coming down to the Quermount and the Paterberg. The last climb, it was just, you know, pressure was climbing and pressure was mounting, and then be one rider, two riders, an acceleration on the Quermount, and then a mano-a-mano on the Paterberg. You know, that's what we often saw with, say, Cancellara and Sagan. But all of a sudden, you had this situation where these two guys slip away. Having one of them on Quickstep obviously helps because, they've had such powers and numbers that they can shut the race down. But it's possible, and it has been reproduced on different races since then, to get away at very different points in the race. And all of a sudden, what we've seen in modern racing in Flanders was that there is no right way to get away. There's no key moment to get away. Every moment in the last 50, 60 key kilometers, it's possible to get away and stay away in Flanders. And that's what makes this new course so interesting.
So when you went back and watched it, especially in those last 50K or so, what were some of the moments that really stood out to you and the tactical decisions that were made that you really felt like contributed to the win?
You know, just that, you know, first when you see Terpstra attack and Christoph is on his wheel, you say, okay, well, this is, you know, classic Quickstep move, putting Terpstra out there. Terpstra at the time was, you know, there's probably their third card. So yeah, you send him out about 30K, he'll probably get caught, but may offer support later on to Boonen or one of the other guys. But on this day, and then you see Christoph go with him. Christoph's a sprinter, you know, known to be a sprinter. People hesitate. I think they didn't really expect him to go the distance. And then they just... But then all of a sudden what happens is in the back, somebody's got to close that gap, and that gets tricky. And as the kilometers tick off, it gets harder and harder. And somebody either has to be really super strong to be able to get across on the Karma or sacrifice themselves. And we didn't see that happening. That situation we saw also very much with Gilbert's victory, which was – perhaps my actual favorite sentimental victory, because I'm a big Gilbert fan, and I think what he showed there was just the absolute science of racing, his ability to analyze a race and play other riders off of each other. He's so masterful at that. We saw it again last year in Roubaix. I thought that was just tremendous. But the reason and I don't think anybody does it as well as him, really, but the reason I chose 15 was that this ride by Terpstra and Christoph was the first time we saw that play out in Flanders, and it's really changed the dynamics of that monument.
Something I also love about Flanders is the fact that, you know, you get to do the sportive the day before, and so you get to actually ride the climbs and see the terrain and see what it's all about. And so Terpstra attacks, and Christoph goes after him, and it's on this slight rise. It's after the Kreuzberg, and the Kreuzberg is hard. I mean, it's steep and it's really painful, and the cobblestones at the top are really sucky. And a lot of times there is sort of there's this like regrouping that happens at the top of the Kreuzberg because people are tired. You're heading towards a feed zone, but the road, then it's paved and it goes up this slight rise. It's a real power climb. And this was actually the climb that several years later Terpstra attacked on when he won the 2018 edition. That was like his launch pad, was this very stretch of road. And that's where these guys went. And it's sort of this innocuous stretch of road that it's not a cobbled climb. It's like the the rise that comes after the cobbled climb, that if you are ambitious enough and there's a let up in the action because people are trying to catch their breath, there can be a moment of hesitation. The other thing I remember about that year is that, boy, Sepp van Marck, again, having problems like right before the big action. You know, I think that was where like he had a flat or his brake was rubbing or something, and he kind of got caught out by the initial surge and had to catch up to the group. And is like just about to catch on right when Terpstra goes.
Yeah. Another thing about that year that I liked, I think we saw in 2015, really the first look at the kind of new Quickstep mindset in the post Bonin era. That's when we first really saw that dynamic where the team wasn't really just built around Bonin anymore. It was being built around all these different pillars that they could come into play. And that's why I think Quickstep really turned the page after Bonin retired, because he was such a central focus to that team. And during the Northern Classics, when he finally did retire a year or two after that, that's when we saw the scenarios where the Terpstra goes up the road and you have Joubert, Stibar, and Lampert all holding back, waiting to come over the top, waiting to bridge across. And they've been able to play that card year in and year out. And that's why Quickstep is always a factor in all these races in the Northern Classics.
Well, it was very visible that year because, you know, Bonin was starting to show the signs of aging. But, you know, that mentality goes back with Quickstep, before Domo, all the way back to Mapai. And that was Patrick Lefebvre's mentality when he built the Mapai team around classics riders. And they all, you know, at the time it was Musiu who was their leader, but they also won with Taffy. They also won with Ballerini. And the mentality was that they would go into it with one leader, but they had other cards to play. And that's just the way they race. We're doing a feature on Philippe Gilbert I'm preparing for Roubaix. And he talks about last year's Roubaix when he was in the last break with Lampard. And actually, at one point, he got orders to let Lampard drift off the front. So that, you know, that shows how they always are playing so many cards at one point. And it works even better when they don't have an overwhelmingly dominant leader like Musiu, or even more so Bonin, who was obviously the greatest classics rider of the cobbles in modern history.
Something else that stands out about this year is that was a very chiseled Christoph. I mean, he was lean and mean. He's a guy, you know, he's a bigger guy. He's a guy that we've seen look, I wouldn't say doughy. I mean, they're all pro cyclists, so they're very skinny and very cut. But he's a guy that, like, you know, you've seen him look bigger and smaller. And that year he was, I just remember like looking at his calf muscles and it's like, wow, that guy is so cut. He is jacked and really, really fit looking. And I think that showed itself on the Paterberg, which is, you know, Terpstra and Christoph come into the Paterberg, which is just such a steep final climb. And you'd think that, you know, okay, Terpstra, this is his last opportunity to get rid of Christoph. And, you know, Christoph, he's this heavy sprinter. You know, Terpstra should be able to ride away from him. And it's actually Christoph who looks better on the climb than Terpstra, and I think leads the way up the Paterberg. So that was one of those moments where you're like, wow, you know, Christoph was really, really tip-top shape that year. So yeah. Chapeau to him.
Well, that may also be a little bit due to kits that the Katusha team had back in the day. I have to say that they go down for me as some of the worst, and I don't know that red shorts really make anybody look thin. But it was interesting because he was a big guy. I would call – he is statuesque. I mean, he is massively muscular. I remember after he won San Remo, I talked to him, and I said, you know, all right, what's next? You know, obviously you're good on the cobble classics, Roubaix, Flanders. I said probably Roubaix, huh? Because it's flatter and you're you know, the climbs are probably a little more difficult for you in Flanders. He goes, actually, no, it's quite the opposite. Roubaix, the last 100 kilometers of Roubaix is like this long pursuit race, whereas the final climbs in Flanders, it's like each one of those climbs is a sprint for me. So it's like I'm doing like intensive sprint training. So it actually is better for me, Flanders. And a year later, he won Flanders. So I learned a lot with that conversation with him and continue. And he's been in, the, I think, the top five or six almost every time every race in the last 4 or 5 years.
Interesting. Well, yeah, that was a great addition. 2015, Alexander Kristoff. I chose 2016. That was the year that Peter Sagan won. And, you know, look, the win itself gets overshadowed a bit by Sagan's celebrity. You know, he is a world champion at that time. He's the most popular man in cycling. He wins. It's this big dramatic victory. And you know, he was he's at the peak of his powers at that time. So I think that looking back, you can sort of remember that win as, oh, well, Sagan was just stronger than everybody. But that was not the case. Sagan won through this tactical masterclass that caught his rivals totally off guard. So storylines going into 2016 is you have the rise of Sagan. You have Quickstep really with this, like Hoodie said, well-rounded support staff where you have Boonen, Terpstra, Stibar, and Steen Vandenberg, all of whom had been in finales at Flanders before. Then you had the big, big storyline, which is this is Fabian Cancellara's final year racing, so his last classics campaign. So, you know, could he win 4 Flanders? Could he win a 4th Roubaix? You know, you had some, you know, Kwiatkowski and Sky, they had a pretty good classics squad as well, maybe not at the same level as a Quickstep or as a Trek Segafredo or Tinkoff, but they were there right as well. What I really liked about this edition is, like the 2015 edition, this was an edition that was won with a move that was made pretty far out. So it's, you know, 35K from the finish when Sagan makes his move. And so the way the race went down, Greg Van Avermaet crashed out, 100 kilometers to go, so no BMC. His entire team went down, and he did not get back up. But you have this situation in which there's a break up the road. The group hits the Quermont for the second time. Then they go on to the Koppenberg. Then they go on to some of the other smaller bergs, the Tienberg. And there's a ton of aggression on the Tienberg, and a front group gets out. Well, a front group of favorites that has Vandenberg, Stibar, De Volder, Gato, Sagan, Terpstra, Boonen, a bunch of guys from Sky, Sepp van Marck, and Cancellara. So all the big dogs are in this group, and they're speeding towards the Kreuzberg. And you're thinking, boy, either something big's going to happen on the Kreuzberg, or everyone is just going to wait for the Oud Quermont and, like, punch it then. And first, Kwiatkowski goes, and Sagan goes with him. And this is on, like, a flat stretch of road in the run into the Kreuzberg. And it's sort of this innocuous stretch of road. And you're like, wait, these guys are going on the flats? And Cancellara has this opportunity to go. You can see it on the clip. You go back and watch it a million times. He has Stijn De Volder on the front. And De Volder, like, reaches back to Cancellara, like, hey, man, I will sling you up there. And Cancellara is like, no. And look, you know, who knows? It's been lost to time. But my assumption was always that Cancellara thought, this is too early to go out. I'm going to wait for the Quermont. That's when I want to go. That's maybe what my tactics are telling me, is wait for the Quermont. If these young idiots want to go out here with 33K to go with the Kreuzberg and the run into the Quermont and the Quermont left to go, I'm going to let them do it and burn themselves out. And that was that moment of hesitation that made the race, because Sagan gets away with Kwiatkowski. Sepp van Marke goes up and joins them. Those three go up, catch the main break, and all of a sudden you have this scenario where Peter Sagan has an advantage going into the Quermont, and it's not huge, it's like 30 seconds. And that was it, though. Like, Cancellara attacks on the Quermont, drops everybody. Sagan attacks on the Quermont, drops Kwiatkowski. Van Marck goes with him. And at the top of the Quermont, it's only 10 seconds. Like, Cancellara is right there. You're like, man, Cancellara 2010 bridges that gap and catches those guys. But Cancellara 2016, he's still 10 seconds short, and that was it. The 10 seconds turned into 16. They hit the Paterberg. Sagan makes his move at the Paterberg, drops Van Marke, who Cancellara makes his move on the Paterberg, but still, it's like still 10, 12 seconds at the top of the Paterberg, and that's it. Time trial to the finish, and Sagan takes his win. But if you really look at Sagan's victory, it's because he had the stones to put himself out there with 33Ks to go on the flat road, and Cancellara didn't want to go with him. And both of them were super strong. You know, had they come into the Paterberg together, I don't know who wins. You may have seen a repeat of 2013 when Cancellara dropped Sagan. But what I really liked about it was that it was just a very tactical battle. You know, did we learn from it? I don't know. I mean, I think it was just another scenario in which we learned that, like, if you are strong enough and willing to go from far out, you can catch people off guard and get a head start into some of these crucial climbs.
Yeah, that was one of the greatest additions of the Flanders, simply just the big party and the vibe and the feeling that was going on in that race. You know, all the hype going into Flanders, this builds during that week. I remember I was kind of late to the whole Flanders party because, you know, if the Velenews used to send me to the Ardennes every year. So I never even went to Flanders. I don't think that might have actually been my first year, 2016 or maybe 2015. So just to be there on the ground and just feel that groundswell building during that whole week was so spectacular. And then to have, of course, Sagan, you know, win in the rainbow jersey, and for him coming in and to win like that, being such a rock star that he is, you know, the Flanders fans just went absolutely crazy. That was the year he stood on the roof of the car. He's like, and he's playing up to the crowds and had his big hairy mange there of hair. And it was a Sagan in full splendor. And it really was the passing of the torch from the generation of the Cancellara Bonin generation to this new generation of, you know, led by Sagan, whom, you know, still is only 30. And some people are talking about, you know, maybe his time is done.
Well, he talks about that, you know, he's the one who keeps putting that out there. How much longer can I continue? But it's true that, you know, what I thought was so amazing about that year was, you know, when you actually look, you know, on paper at the amount of monuments that he's won, he's only won two, I believe, right?
Yeah.
But he's done them with such style and such, you know, that it's, you know, and I think both of them he did with the rainbow stripes on his shoulders. So, you know, and when he's on. I think he was going to be on this year. I'll tell you that, because he has a tendency to sort of pop it every really big every other year. And he was close last year, even though he's a little off key. He was really close in Roubaix. I think he would probably really been on this year. But that was just a spectacular victory. And I think also I agree with you, Andy. You know, I came to the new course late. The first several years, you know, there was a lot of criticism about the new course. I remember this when it started. Geez, I can't even remember where it started the first time. St. Nicholas, I think, is the first time. And then we moved to Bruges for the start. And then we had the circuit on the end, which, you know, initially took, eliminated the Muir, which was, you know, many people, you know, really didn't like, but it's become very, in the last 5 years, I'd say probably since Sagan's victory, we really see sort of the genius of this new course and the way that Flanders Classics has transformed, the Tour Flanders and its other races into something much bigger and much more international than they ever used to be.
Yeah, and something that also stands out about that Sagan win is that a lot of times, you know, I think we do look at Sagan as, oh, he's so strong, you know, and we, when he did win, we were coming out of this Bonin and Cancellara phase in which, you know, the races were often won with like blunt force, which was just some show of force that was so much stronger. You know, Cancellara was just so much stronger than everyone else on this section of road, or Bonin was just so much stronger and rode away from everybody. And we even saw that in 2013, which was the showdown between Sagan and Cancellara on the Paterberg, where the young Sagan is able to follow Cancellara on the Quermont, and then they get to the Paterberg. And Cancellara just like, it's like he squeezes his head until it explodes. You know, he just dials it up on the Paterberg and right at the top puts in this burst of speed, and Sagan is just squashed, you know, squashed flat like a bug. But that's not the way that Sagan won it. He was tactical. He was smart. He was cagey. He goes with this early move that Cancellara probably could have gone with and decides not to. And I think Cancellara is relying on the old way of winning, which is just bring a bigger hammer to the fight. But, you know, when Sagan has a 30-second advantage on you because he was smart and took a chance, there's nothing you can do.
But at the end, he still won it. You know, he won solo on the Paterberg.
Yep.
Just, you know, and he put the squeeze down on Van Mark that year. So it still came down to the Paterberg, which is, you know, the Paterberg is an amazing climb. I once rode it with Robbie McEwen and years ago. And that's it was only then where I really understood it, because everything until then was really about – the Quermount And this is a time back in the day when these climbs came much earlier in the race as well. But you had this long drive up the old Quare Mount, and where it's hardest is not the steepest part in the beginning, but it's after they come through the little village and that long false flat into the wind with lots of side winds. And then they come out on the main road, they go down and up, and then they drop down and they hit the Paterberg again. And what I understood then was what makes the Paterberg so hard is that there is very little time to recover after the Quare Mount. And the genius of this new course was that repetition of doing it two and three times. And so by the time they hit that last Quare Mount Paterberg thing, it's lethal.
Yeah, Paterberg sucks. It's hard. I've suffered on that thing. So hard. I've suffered on that thing without racing up the Haute Quare Mount. So, Hoodie, you chose 2019. This past year, we were both there. That was the year in which Alberto Bettiol won. What can you tell me about rewatching it?
Yeah, I chose last year in fact, it kind of dovetails a lot of what we've just been talking about kind of into that race last year. I thought kind of brought together some of these themes that, the race, the Flanders and just the Northern Classics in general were no longer dominated by one or two big stars or one or two big teams. I think last year really reflected how deep the Northern Classics peloton is right now in contemporary cycling and how committed all the top world tour teams are to building out a really strong classics program. Just looking at the top 10, top 11 last year, no team had more than one rider in the top 10 last year. So it was a wide representation across the peloton. And I thought last year also kind of brought together this kind of new generation of classic stars to the fore. Mainly for me, Matthew Vanderpool, just what he did last year in the Spring Classics. You know, I was there for most of his run there last year in the Northern Classics. Just absolutely spectacular. And, he didn't win, of course, remember last year he punctured right before the final double of the Quare Mount in Paterberg. Remember, he kind of bunny hopped that curb and punctured and crashed. You know, everyone thought his race was done. And for him to chase back and to actually finish fourth just off the podium, just really, for me, just really revealed the depth and quality of Vanderpool. I mean, one of the best quotes of the year last year was from our man there, Heinrich Hausler, who said, "Vanderpool's so good, he pisses diamonds and shits gold." You know, that's one for the ages. And that kind of just summed up, I thought, last year. We saw so many new young riders really step up last year. Asgreen was second. You know, of course, he's a big name that's going to be keep winning races for years. Vanderpool was there. Niels Pollitt was fifth, and he was on the podium at Roubaix the next weekend. Nason, even Valverde, Greg Van Avermaet, and Sagan were in the top 11. So it's kind of like this transitional between the old guard and the new guard, this kind of pushing into this new peloton that's deeper with a much broader representation across the world tour. So all the storylines kind of just weave together, I thought, to make a really great addition last year of Flanders. I mean, kind of recapping the race briefly, there was the kind of the break went away. Asgreen was actually in that early break. Van Barrow was out there with Vandenberg, the big man. I love Vandenberg. He's an old Flanderan, old horse. He was out in the break early last year. That group kind of came back together. The Kuisberg, really is where the race gets hard, and that's where it happened last year. And then it really just went off on the Quare Mount. There was a selection there over the Kuisberg going into the Quare Mount. Big selection. There was kind of it split up. That group was off the front still. Big selection in the back. I think there was like 15, 20 guys. And then Bettiol, you know, who had never won a race in his entire life, just is that perfectly timed, impeccably timed solo flyer, you know, kind of the middle of the Quare Mount, and just goes. And it was one of those situations where maybe a few riders were out of position. And that's where Vanderpool was chasing back on. So he was not positioned to go after him. I remember Van Avermaet saying he was kind of got blocked in lower on the Quare Mount, couldn't really chase when Bettiol went. And then it was one of those situations where everyone kind of started looking at each other. And at that point, there weren't a lot of teammates to help the chase. So that's kind of why I thought last year's edition really kind of brought together a lot of these different kind of new tendencies in the Northern Classics racing we're seeing right now.
Yeah, whenever you get to the point where there's no teammates left to pull for their leader, racing really gets interesting, and that certainly happened last year. It happened like also the year Gilbert won. Just, you know, you get it down, it becomes this mano a mano, and all of a sudden 20 seconds is like 2 minutes because somebody's got to make that effort to close the gap, and they're sacrificing their own chances by doing it. And it gets you know, really interesting. And Betiol was, you know, okay, he maybe benefited a little bit from being unknown or lesser known, you know. I think he was teammates with Van Avermaet in the past, and Van Avermaet, you know, who doesn't really – never criticizes another rider, says, you know, to be honest, he never showed that kind of form when he was my teammate. But you talk to Van Mark. I talked to Van Mark this year at Tour de Provence, I think, you know, and EF – has put together one heck of a good classics team, and they showed it, really showed it there last year. Flanders, and Van Mark himself went off in the early break on the Papenburg, I believe, huh? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, and he was, we thought, their leader. What's he doing going off so early, right? But he was a little under form, and so he was putting his, you know, he decided to throw his eggs into the, you know, to work for Betiol, and they were already, when you look back on it, they were working for Betiol that day very early on, although not too many people really knew who he was at that level, but they knew who he was. Van Mark said, hey, you know, I remember in the Tour de France when Rigoberto Urán got second, Betiol was like the last team rider able to pace Betiol on the climbs when there's maybe only 15 guys like Chris Froome still in the front pack. So he's, you know, they understood just how strong he was, and he, you know, he had his head on right, and the whole team now – and they've got one heck of a good classics team, and so I think the mood there is such that you know, they're yet one, like you said, Andy, one of, you know, it used to be sort of step in the rest of the world, but now there's a lot of teams that can are going into these races with big confidence. It's really a shame. It's really a shame that we were deprived of this year's classics, because it's always such an amazing time, and based on last year, I think it was going to be really just tremendous, a tremendous classic season. You know, could Vanderpool, you know, duplicate what he did last year, or was it going to be harder now that everybody's looking at him, and Betiol and all these young faces, Oliver Neisen, who's been knocking on the door for a couple years now. You know, it was gonna be a great one. It might still be sometime this fall, who knows, but it's gonna be a very different classic season, that's for sure.
Yeah, a couple things stand out to me about last year. I mean, Hoodie, you and I were there. I think we were watching the final kilometer on one of those TVs set up in the main square there at Oudenaarde, and then I remember watching the finale on the EF Education bus. But you know, EF Education, previously Cannondale, like, they've had strong classics teams in the past, not this strong, but they've always sort of tried weird stuff with trying to set Sepp Van Mark up, you know, sending guys off early. I remember they used to always have like Dylan Van Barle go really early in sort of not the earliest break, but sort of the second break. And then Langeveld would do that as well. And I feel like what I remember from last year is that they all stayed together, and it was Van Marke, like you said, James, who went off sort of Koppenberg, Kruisberg area, and got into this breakaway, which allowed Betiol and Langeveld to stay in the group. If I'm getting the names wrong, I'm sorry, it's been a while since I watched this, but I just know that Betiol was able to stay in the main group. And then once Betiol did go, they had Van Marke and Langeveld in the main group, who were just getting towed along. So it was one of these situations where you're like, wow, you know, EF Pro Cycling has the numerical advantage in this situation, and it's just not something we've seen in the past, because usually there's like a crash or a mechanical, or, you know, they have the strength, but like Van Marke, you know, has a flat tire or something. So I'll always remember that. And then I'm with you. I thought they were going to chase him back. You know, Betiol put in that great attack on the Quermont, and it was huge. I mean, it was 19 seconds or something like that by the top, but still, I looked around and I was like, they're going to bring this guy back. Sagan, Van Avermaet, Van Der Poel, Wout van Aert. That's a ton of firepower. And they just, I think everyone was really, really tired.
Yeah. No, it was the amount of, you know, all those names we're looking forward to are, you know, Pedersen, who was second there, what, 2 years ago, and is the world champion now, showed really good form pairings. And the number of potential new stories that were going to be written this year was really exciting.
So looking at how the classics stars had been riding in the lead up to when racing stopped and how some of these teams had been riding. I know that feels like it was a million years ago. How do you guys think the 2020 Flanders would have played out? Who would have won? And which teams do you think would have been particularly strong and dynamic at this year's race?
Go for it, James.
Well, I think EF was going to be there. Obviously, Quickstep is always there, except, you know, they didn't have a big name rider this year. They had a couple riders that were going to, you know, move up, and they've always managed to move those riders up. Guys, you know, Stibar showed good form winning the stage in Argentina. Lampard is always strong. He was strong in Newsby, but they didn't have a big name to focalize the team. Vanderpool, you know, only just started racing, it seemed like. So there's no reason to believe he wasn't going to be there. But I think Sagan still has at least one more big monument in him. And I think he would have been, he was been riding really strong. He's just coming off an altitude camp. He doesn't need to win a lot anymore. The only races that motivate him are these big ones. So I think that he was going to be very hard to beat. It's hard for me to come up with a clear cut scenario. I felt very strongly that Gilbert would have won San Remo. I had that scenario all written out in my head. But this one was going to be tougher.
Yeah, the first real glimpse we got of just where people were on form, and that was the opening weekend. And the opening weekend had Newsblatt and Koen Bressel-Kern. And Stuyven was there, very strong, you know, a huge win for him. And then Osgren won Koen Bressel-Kern. You know, both of those guys were just absolutely flying. I mean, Stuyven, you know, here's a guy who's been banging around, you know, the classics. He's been, you know, he's a big guy, so he's never going to really win. You know, it's going to be Flanders or Roubaix for that guy. And it just seemed like he was really flying on good form. And another guy was going really well in the early season with Nizzolo. Kind of hit, you know, he had a lot of tough injuries, but he had a couple of impressive early season wins. And then, you know, we just didn't really get a real good look at guys like Gilbert. You know, they were kind of, you know, because they're building their peak toward, you know, coming into, you know, really later in the spring season. And Christophe, again, this year was looking very good. I don't think he won before racing stopped, but I think he had a handful of top fives, and he was looking quite good.
You know who else was looking really good was Team Sunweb. You know, James, you were there at Paris-Nice, and I was so impressed with Thijs Benoot and Michael Matthews and the way they were riding at that race. I was also really impressed with Ivan Garcia Cortina on Bahrain McLaren. I don't know if he had necessarily the strongest team to be able to win Flanders, but like he won a stage, and he was like second or third at another stage and was always up there in those crosswind sections. So just like based on what happened at Paris-Nice, I looked at some of those guys, Soren Krau Anderson, another guy who was riding really well. So I think that we could have seen a pretty dynamic classic season.
Well, one of the teams that impressed me the most Paris-Nice, not Paris-Roubaix, in terms of a race like Flanders, was Trek. That stage two was some of the hardest crosswinds I've ever worked in. It was really hard. That race just broke apart and broke apart and broke apart. And Trek was just driving it at the front. I mean, Pedersen with the world champion jersey on, just driving it for Stuyven. And you know, they came up short with the win, but they were really there as a powerhouse team. EF also just powerhouse team in situations that have a direct link to races like Flanders.
Well, it could have been a situation in which this year was the beginning of a change of the guard. You know, with Quickstep and Askren coming up, with Trek Segafredo really finding their horses, Bob Jungels, and then, you know, guys like Garcia Cortina, Sunweb, and EF all looking strong. We will never know what the 2020 Tour of Flanders, the springtime Tour of Flanders, would have happened, but here's hoping that we get to see some fall action going. Well, guys, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts on this past edition of Flanders. I think let's do that with Roubaix next week. This was fun. I actually gained a lot of insight into this. So for Andrew Hood and James Start, thank you for tuning into the Villainies Podcast. We will see you all next week.